This is called an American badger, and I don't know why I didn't check its passport, but maybe it is. When I was growing up, farmers shot badgers because every farmer that you talked to, their best horse had stepped in a badger hole and broken its leg. Their best cow had stepped in a badger hole and broke its leg. And I never did see their real broken legs, but everybody had that story. So badgers, a lot of people shot badgers. Well, on our farm, we welcome badgers. And we have a community of badgers who basically goes through our land over about a three-year cycle, and they dig out the gophers. And so they help control the gopher populations. So if you don't have badgers, what's plan B? Plan B is strychnine. Strychnine, you mix it with grain, put it in the gopher hole, gopher eats it. If the gopher dies on the surface, a bird can come along, a badger can come along, and all of a sudden, Rachel Carson, when you put a chemical or a toxin or a poison into the atmosphere, it goes all the way around and it comes back here. So we love badgers. It took us years to get a picture of badgers because they're very, very shy. And they are on the species at risk. And one of my favorites, the meadowlark. I tell this story very often. I probably don't have to tell it again, but I will. When we took holistic management, when we got back from the course, I walked out in the spring and I started looking at our native prairie. And there was very, very little grass because I had been overgrazing year after year after year. And I started thinking, the meadowlarks had disappeared from our farm in 1989, and we'd only been there 6 years. And I started thinking, did we overgraze the land so that they did not have any habitat for nests? So as we rested our native prairie, some of it for a year, some for almost 2 years, I think it was the year 2000, 11 years later, I was doing my chores about 5:45 in the morning, and I heard a meadowlark. And that was a pretty emotional moment for me because I started to connect the dots, and I thought, by resting the native prairie, did we really create habitat for them again? And we did, because they just kept coming more and more and more. So there again is we have the ability to turn things around, but it takes action. And just not having any income off that native prairie for a few years, it's very hard to explain to a farmer that, well, maybe we just have to do without meadowlarks. So the rest of the story is, what good are meadowlarks for? Well, when we get into a drought, like we did this year, grasshoppers move in. And if we have a dry winter and a dry spring, we will have an epidemic next spring of grasshoppers because they've been busy laying their eggs all through late July, August, and into September. So next spring, I'm hoping the meadowlarks come back and they bring all their relatives because they love terrestrial insects, of which grasshoppers are terrestrial insects. So they are part of the balance of nature on our farm. They help control populations of insects.
They also are part of the music of your land.
Yes. This is, Marie got this picture of, it's a Sprague's pipit's nest. And there again, in the fall, we went into fall, the pasture had been grazed and it was still very, we leave lots. And the reason we leave lots is specifically for habitat. The Sprague's pipits love lots of litter, lots of dead grass, because they make an igloo. And I had never ever found a Sprague's pipit's nest before. But in 2008, I found two, and they were 50 yards apart. And Sprague's pipits, the males have sometimes two or three females. So in this little 7-acre pasture, the Sprague's pipits had two nests, and they usually have about 5 eggs, but it was so easy to walk by that. It was so well camouflaged. And like, to me, that's a wonder of nature to see that. And Sprague's pipits are on the endangered list in Saskatchewan. They're on the species of risk in Alberta. This is a pileated woodpecker. Glenn, in his surveys, has never ever seen one on our farm, but I see them every year. Last year, for the first time, I saw a male and a female. They came into the yard, they landed on our power pole, and they stayed there for about 20 minutes, digging insects out. And after 19 minutes, I went in the house to get the camera, and I came out, and they were gone. So I missed that Kodak opportunity. But about 3 years ago, I was doing I had the cattle, the grazing cattle, in one of the quarter sections, and I was going out there about 5:45 every morning. Pardon me, no, about 5:40, and at 5:45, this pileated woodpecker would fly over. And that happened for about 2 weeks in a row. Well, then the cattle moved, so I was away from that area. This year, I'm out in that area again, and at 5:40, this woodpecker's flying over. The second day, there's two of them, and I'm thinking, they're probably a male and a female, but I wasn't close enough. The third day, there were three of them, and I said, this is the first time I've ever seen they've got a baby, they've got a child. Well, the next day, there was five of them. They had three young ones, and I mean, I'm like, wow. And if you look in the Birds of Alberta book, it says that a pileated woodpecker needs about 100 acres of mature wooded trees in order for it to stay in that area, a breeding pair. They need that for habitat. And we've got a lot of trees in our farm, but public lands, the government owns a half section of land right beside us. And it's 320 acres of very mature prairie and lots of mature trees. So that is a real asset to our farm. So people say, you're really doing a lot of good things, but we have neighbors that haven't tore up all their pasture either. So everybody's contributing, I believe, to this, these different birds showing up. You've probably heard me say this before too, that every third bite of food that we take depends on a pollinating insect. Einstein said that if we lose our pollinators, we've got 4 years left to eat. Now, I've had a few people come up to me after a conference and say, do you know that in China they've been manually pollinating some of their fruits and vegetables for 15 or 20 years? And I actually did come across that on the internet. So that's pretty sobering. And so in 2003, we took an interest in our farm on planting, instead of planting conifers like spruce and pine and deciduous trees like maples and poplars, we went whole hog into planting a lot of berry bushes like chokecherry, buffalo berry, sea buckthorn, probably about five different varieties. And what we noticed was that as those trees started to flower the following spring, that we had more insects showing up, which coincidentally pollinate. And when they're pollinating the flowers, they're flying into our fields, our pastures, and they're pollinating the alfalfa. And this year we had a group of people, and I'm driving down the fence beside all these berry bushes, and somebody said that there's 10 yards or 10 meters that you have set aside for those two rows of trees. Isn't that a terrible waste? And I stopped the truck, and I got out, and we got over the wire, and I said, see the alfalfa here? Let's see how many paces it is. So we stepped out, and it was about 12 paces. I said, the alfalfa, as you go further away from the trees that the bugs have been pollinating, the production goes down. So I said, the production has probably doubled in that area that we've displaced. So, and plus those trees, if you come by the farm in March, you'll see the snowdrifts from about 4 feet into that pasture, about 10 meters. So we're getting water for the pasture. We're getting more pollination from the trees that the birds are pollinating. And pardon me, the insects. By the way, birds do pollinate, and that's the hummingbird. So, pollinators are a big thing. And no, we're not wasting anything. We're providing habitat. In fact, the way Marie and I look at it is when we travel, we like to find a restaurant, or pardon me, a motel and a restaurant close by. So the way we planted our trees, there's a row of maples or a row of ash and then the berry bushes. So they can dine on the berry bushes and they can nest in the trees. So we're trying to look out. Now, looking back at some of the mistakes that I made when I was farming conventionally, and that was, you have, when you farm, you can look at it two ways. You can say, this is the standard of living that we want, and the land, we're going to farm the land so it supplies us with that standard of living. Or we can look at the land and ask the land the question, what standard of living can you afford to give us? And Wendell Berry, he alludes to that. And that's a question that has to be asked of any farmer, I believe, when they start farming. If they have illusions or delusions of grandeur, they'll end up clearing all of their land very, very quickly. I have a friend that came by in 2001 when I was building 150 birdhouses to put on the farm. That was one of the goals when we left holistic management, that we wanted to put birdhouses on our farm to increase the biodiversity on our farm. And that goal has happened. We now have 240 birdhouses. This friend asks me to check all the birdhouses around the 1st of June to see where the bluebirds are nesting. And he comes and he bans them. You have to have a license. You have to have gone to a session where they kind of school you on how to band. And this particular mother has been banded. So we took that band number, and he emailed it into the American Bluebird Society. And they emailed back, and they said that bird was banded within 5 miles of this nesting box. So he built 68 birdhouses in 2001, and he put 10 on our farm. In 2002, he said, can I put another 10 on your farm? So he went and got them from another piece of property. All of his birdhouses on our farm now, because he said, we're getting more bluebirds in our houses than he was on the other farms, and also we're getting more eggs. We've had as many as 9 eggs to a hatch, and that doesn't happen every year. This year was a very poor year. We probably averaged about 4 eggs, but to me, this picture is kind of a motivation for me. That bluebird, she wouldn't fly off the nest. He picked her up, looked underneath at how the little ones were coming along. But like, she really believes that what she's doing is really important, protecting her young for the future of her species. And I think we, as farmers, have to look at agriculture and how we farm the land the same way. After took her off the nest, this is the 8 little ones. And they will be, they'll have left the nest 14 to 15 days after they hatch. Like, that's going from grade 1 to grade 12 really quickly. And the interesting thing is that, there again, they love terrestrial insects. They love the grasshoppers. So when we go into a drought early in the spring and the bluebirds are there, in fact, they may already have they may already know, the ones that were around this year, that, hey, there's lots of eggs being laid here, so let's get back here in the spring. So if we have an early drought, we could possibly have one hatch that would be already fledged. In other words, leave the nest by the first week of June, and if there continues to be a lot of grasshoppers, they will have another hatch. And if the drought continues right into fall, we could have 3 hatches. So when somebody says to me, what good comes out of a drought? Well, I said, that's a tough question. But he said, the good that comes out of it is that when there's lots of food, these bluebirds are going to just keep increasing their populations. And they are also going into the tank. We're really struggling on our farm to, I think we had 16 houses this year, and we've been up as high as 24. An early spring blizzard will absolutely annihilate them, because they depend on insects. And in April of 2007, we had a 3-day blizzard. And when the blizzard was over, we had snowdrifts up against our buildings that were blue from dead bluebirds. And we had gone from 24 houses that spring down to 6. So it really devastated the populations. And they're just absolutely gorgeous. This is a bluebird's nest. They like to use native grasses. And notice that nest is very neat. It's very, very well made. And when I was cleaning the nest out that fall, I thought there was hardly anything in there. They remove their droppings on a daily basis. Even feathers they take out. And I'm thinking that they build a nest, they feed their young, and the nest is clean when they leave. Isn't that a metaphor as to how we should look after the land? I think it is. And just nature has a way. Mm-hmm. We put this nesting float box on a dugout that's right in our yard, thinking that maybe we'll, in the next couple of years, we will get a couple of geese to come and lay eggs. Well, it was out there for about 5 days, and they showed up. And there were three pairs showed up, and they all fought for it. And, of course, the bigger ones won it. So she laid eggs, and finally she started to set. So I took out my Birds of Alberta book, and I looked, and it said 28 to about 30 days and from the time she starts setting until the eggs hatch. So we kept track on the calendar. 28 days came, nobody hatched. 30 days came, nothing yet. 31 days, nothing. And I said to Maria, I said, they're not fertile, or maybe she left the nest for too long and the eggs got cold. And she says, they're going to hatch. And I think it was like 34 days. I was out doing my chores. I came back in the yard at about 6:30 in the morning, and Marie was out taking a gazillion pictures. She was so proud. These are our first grandchildren. So we were very proud of that. And we would go down. It was a Sunday, and we would go down and just sit on the edge of the dugout and look at this marvel of nature. And there again, somebody says, well, that's really neat, Don, but what good are they? And I said, just get over it. It's good for the spirit. And your class is called the Spirit of the Land, and the land is giving us the spirit.